The great philosopher Socrates once said that an unexamined life is not worth living. And what we've been saying the last few weeks is that an unexamined faith is not worth believing. And there are a lot of people who embrace different religions and different faiths, and there are even some who embrace Christianity in a way, but they really don't know what it is that they believe. And next week we're going to be looking at what I think is probably the second largest religion in the world, and that's nominal Christianity. That would be people who say they believe something about the Christian faith, but they really don't have a relationship with God because they don't really know what they believe. And that accounts for a large number of people in the world. But this week, we're going to finish up on the major world religions, and we're going to take a look at Buddhism today. Now, we showed you the chart the last couple weeks, and when you look at the population of the world, about 30% of the world embraces Christianity, about 20% of the world embraces Islam, and about 14% embraces Hinduism, which leaves about 6% that embrace Buddhism. And let me just say that a lot of the Eastern religions are offshoots of Hinduism, Buddhism, and their counterparts. In fact, in the course of trying to kind of break down religion into broad categories, there really you could almost break the world's religions down into two categories. The category of religions that embrace reality. What I mean by that is religions that actually believe that the physical universe is here, that you are sitting here, the chair you're sitting in is real, that it's a true thing, it's not an illusion. And then the religions that believe that everything that you can taste, touch, smell, or feel, anything that you can see, anything that comes in through the senses is not real and it's not true, it's an illusion, it's a figment of your imagination, and that's not the way things are. And really, in many ways, you have Christianity, and then later on Islam, which came later than Christianity, that embraced this view that things are real, that there's a real world in which we live. And then you have Hinduism, which is the proponent of the other view, that everything you see is not really real, it's an illusion. And Buddhism is an offshoot of Hinduism. And many of the other religions that come from that are simply breakdowns of Hinduism. And Hinduism is where that whole point of view started in India. The difference between Hinduism and Buddhism is that Hinduism had no founder and no real prophet that began the religion. It was the Hindu priest that began to develop this religion over a period of time. Buddhism, on the other hand, is an offshoot of Hinduism that does have a founder. A well-known founder. You guys probably have seen pictures of the Buddha. And there was an actual man who was the Buddha. The man was Siddhartha Gautama. And Gautama lived in the 6th century B.C. And he was born in northeastern India, which is now in the area of Nepal. And he was born, and his life really encapsulates Buddhist thought. In other words, Buddhism comes from him, and though it's taken on myriads of forms since then, in order to understand Buddhism, you've got to understand the life of Buddha. And so I want to give you a quick overview of Buddha's life. There were three periods in Buddha's life, and the first period was the period of affluence. Buddha was born into the warrior caste in Indian culture, which is one of the upper castes, and he was born into a life of luxury. His father did not want him to see and experience any kind of suffering or pain, so Buddha was kept in the palace, not allowing to leave the palace, until he was an adult. And there in the palace, he enjoyed all that Indian culture of the royals could experience. He had all the best food, he had all the best entertainment, he had all the best teaching, he had all the best training, he had all the best in Hindu philosophy taught to him, and he experienced all that. He grew up, he got married, he had a son. But something was missing in his life. And the stories and the legends about him say that there came a point in time when he wanted to go outside the walls of the palace to see what the real world was like. And so he ventured outside the walls of the palace, and as he was out on his outing, he observed three different types of suffering. First of all, he saw a sick person. Secondly, he saw an old person. And finally, he saw the corpse of a dead person. And he turned to his charioteer and he said to his charioteer, "What does this mean?" And his charioteer said back to him, "Well, everybody experiences sickness, everybody experiences old age, and everybody experiences death. That's part of the human condition." Now that greatly bothered Buddha. He was very disturbed by that. And on the way back to the palace, they passed an ascetic. An ascetic is a man who embraced the Indian philosophy that this world is an illusion, that it doesn't really exist, and that suffering is not real, and so I don't want to live to attain material possessions or even know where my next meal is coming from. I need to kill my desire and just kind of beat my body and my physical self into control. So he was wandering around, and he seemed to have a tranquil look on his face, which raised the question with Buddha, maybe reality, truth, and all that is found in asceticism. And so he left his palace, left his life of affluence, and began the second part of his life. And the second part of his life, or the second phase of his life, was the period of asceticism. Left his wife and his child behind, and he took on the monk's robes, and he went out and he began to live as an ascetic. The goal was to control all desire through denying the self. And so he denied himself everything down to the very basics. In fact, for a long period of time, he lived on simply one grain of rice a day as his diet. They say he became so emaciated that his ribs showed through his skin as if it was almost hanging off of him. He got to a point where at one point he almost drowned trying to take a bath in the river because he couldn't hardly hold himself up. In addition, in order to rid himself of the desire for popularity or for people to like him, he and his followers, he had five of them at the time, would go out and they would lay in the area where they burned the bodies of dead people and roll around in the ashes just to humiliate themselves, to try to remove themselves of any kind of physical desires or any kind of desires for people. So that's basically the life of asceticism. He did that for about 6 years, and after about 6 years, he accepted a bowl of, some legends say milk, some legends say honey, some legends say soup. He accepted a bowl of soup and said, the way of the ascetic is not right either. It's not affluence, and it's not asceticism. And so he accepted a bowl of soup, and immediately his five followers left him, deserted him, because he'd given up the way. And so he went, and he sat under a tree. And he said he was going to, like he, when he was a child, he used to sit under a tree and think. He would stay under this tree and think until he came to truth, until he became enlightened. Now, the legends are different here. Some say he sat there for 49 days. Some say he sat there for 6 days. Some say he sat there for one day. But these are the things that supposedly happened under the tree. One of the legends say that night, Siddhartha sat under the tree and meditated until dawn. In the first watch of the night, he remembered his past lives. Coming from a Hindu background, believing in reincarnation, he believed he lived in prior lives, so he went through his past lives. And in the second watch of the night, around midnight, he saw how beings die and are reborn through the power of their karma. So he went through the Hindu thinking of reincarnation and the laws of karma, and he thought through all of that and reasoned through all that, which in turn is shaped by the skillfulness of their intentions. So those who live according to the good principles have good karma. Those who live according to bad principles have bad karma. He thought all about that in the second watch of the night. In the third watch, toward dawn, he purified his mind of all cravings, attachments, and defilements, and finally of all intentions, both skillful and not. So he rid himself of all the things that would connect him to the world, all of his desires, all of his intentions, all of his dreams, all of his hopes, all of his plans, all of his thoughts, anything that was about him. And at that time, he attained awakening at the age of 35, thus earning the title Buddha, which means the awakened one. In other words, that's the moment of his enlightenment. Okay? From age 35 on, he began to be a teacher. He gathered some followers. They wrote down what he said and gained some popularity. It really wasn't until a while later that Buddhism actually began to spread. But he basically lived out the rest of his life till about age 80, when he died of food poisoning, of all things, and teaching what he believed and spreading that and sharing that. And so, you know, the question is, what does he believe? Now keep in mind, for those of you who were here last week to hear about Hinduism, he's coming out of Hinduism, so there are a lot of connections between these two. And for those of you who are new, I normally just take the Bible and teach through a passage of the Bible, but we're doing this series on world religions, so I'm trying to tell you what other religions believe, and give you an overview of that. What does Buddhism claim to know? First of all, the first tenet is there is no self. There is no self. The person does not exist. You do not exist. You are simply an illusion. In fact, in Buddhism, it's very interesting, different than Hinduism. In Hinduism, in their belief in reincarnation, your conscious stays intact from lifetime to lifetime. In other words, the conscious you, even though the world in which you live is an illusion, when you're reincarnated into the next life, it's still the kind of you, whoever you are. You keep moving. But in Buddhism, it doesn't believe that. It doesn't believe in the self at all. In fact, it really believes in a conglomerate of components. And that's what you are. Five components. The components that make up you. Physical body, emotions, perception, volition, and consciousness. And all of those, at the time of your death, get scattered and reassembled in the next incarnation. So you're not even existing. You're not the same conscious person. So the physical might go to somebody else, and the volitional might go to somebody else, and the perception might go to somebody else. So really, you really, as you perceive yourself now, your perception of who you are is a component of parts that belong to other things in the past and other people in the past that came together to form the you. But there is no really you. Your consciousness, your reality, that does not exist. It's simply an illusion. Secondly, is the goal of enlightenment is enlightenment by achieving a state of nirvana, which means to extinguish the self. In other words, the ultimate goal is to reach a state where you become aware that you do not exist, and at that point you merge into this void of non-existence, which is reality or truth. It's that which is permanent, and you no longer exist. And Buddha, when he sat under the tree and reached the state of nirvana, enlightenment, this incredible peace came over him because he no longer existed anymore. He ceased to exist, and he was joined in with the void. So that's the ultimate goal, is that you would come to understand that you don't really exist, and that you would accept that, come to terms with that, and become part of the void. Number three, there are lots and lots of different strains of Buddhism, and I can't go into all of them today, but they have very different ideas. Some are atheistic. That is, that the only thing that exists is the void, so there is no God. Some of them believe that you become, when you reach that state of enlightenment, you become like a God, and they're polytheistic. Like Buddha would be like a little God, and all of us become those as we reach the state of enlightenment. Some, like Zen Buddhism, basically are pantheistic. They believe that everything is God, and God is everything. So the trees, the flowers, the air, the sky, consciousness, non-consciousness, all of it is part of a corporate whole which is one, which gives you some insight into the whole Star Wars thinking of the Force, and there's the good side of the Force and the bad side of the Force, but they're really one and the same, and you derive your power from all of nature because all is one and you are one and we're all the same. And that whole concept, that comes from a Zen Buddhist worldview. Number four, Buddhists beliefs vary by culture and can be difficult to pin down. There are many sects and few unified beliefs among Buddhists. However, most sects claim some foundation in the teachings of Buddha. I want you to advance the slide to that one. So it's really hard when you talk about Buddhism, because Confucianism and Taoism and many of the Eastern religions are continual offshoots as different people try to explain their version of Hindu thinking, which Buddhism is a version of Hindu thinking, and trying to wrestle with all that. And so there's lots and lots of different kinds. And most people that embrace a Western Buddhism, an American Buddhism, really have a very different embracing of life than what classical or true Buddhist teaching is. And so it's kind of hard to explain this, because I'll be explaining this to somebody, and someone will say to me, "Well, Tim, you know, I know somebody who's a Buddhist, and they don't believe any of that." Well, that's very possible. But that doesn't necessarily mean it reflects true Buddhism, and American Buddhism typically is really different. It kind of combines not a disillusion of the self, not a movement away from self-identity, but actually a movement toward an embracing of the self, a self-absorption, which is actually the opposite of what Buddha taught, but we have a good way in American culture of trying to take materialism and Western thinking and combine it with Eastern thinking and come up with something that's neither. And that's what's happening in a lot of the teachings today that are being taught by lots and lots of people. What does Buddhism claim to know? Well, there are four noble truths that Buddha taught that form the foundation of Buddhism. He taught four noble truths, and these are universally accepted by Buddhists as the basic teachings of Buddhism. The first truth he taught is that to live is to suffer. That to live is to suffer. When you live in this world, to live in this world, you will suffer. Remember, Buddha went out, he saw the three different states of suffering, and he embraced that. He said suffering is real, which is a departure from Hinduism. Remember, Hinduism says that suffering is an illusion. It doesn't make any difference if somebody's killed. It doesn't make any difference if somebody's mistreated. It doesn't make any difference if someone's in a lower caste. That doesn't matter because that's all an illusion. That's not really real. Doesn't really exist. Well, Buddha says, yes, it does. Suffering is real. People really do suffer. And in that way, we would agree, Christianity would agree with Buddhism, that people do suffer. But the cause is significantly different. He said that suffering is caused by ignorance, which creates in us desire. It's caused by ignorance, which creates in us desire. In other words, since I don't know that I don't exist, and I think I do, I also think that the experience that I have exists, and the world in which I have exists, and so I start desiring the world. I desire food. That makes me hungry. I desire recognition. I desire material pleasure. I desire to own stuff. I desire to have good health. And in the process of desiring things, I find disappointment. I don't get what I want, and that frustrates me. Or maybe I go out and I go after it. In the process of going after it, I do harm to myself. For example, I could overeat because I desire to be satisfied, so I hurt myself in that way. Or I desire to get wealth, and so I go work myself to the bone and really lose the quality of life while I'm trying to acquire wealth, and I'm hurting myself. Or, you know, maybe I just desire to have a good night's sleep. But in the process of that, I've gone through, you know, every Posturepedic mattress I can find, and I can't find the perfect one. And so I'm dissatisfied. And as long as I'm hanging on to desire, as long as I believe that things are real and they can be had, and I hang on to desire, I'm going to suffer in some way, shape, or form. Even birth and death and reincarnation is a form of desire. Because we are subject to the laws of karma, which makes us stay in the cycle and keep coming back again and again and again, because we can't get in our mind that we really don't exist, and so we have to keep living this law of karma, and that creates suffering. The third noble truth that Buddha taught is that you can eliminate suffering by eliminating desire. If you don't desire anything, nothing's disappointing, nothing will hurt you, you can't need anything, you'll have no suffering. And you'll ultimately achieve, in the fourth noble truth, that you can eliminate desire by following the Eightfold Path. So there's a path to eliminate desire so that you can achieve nirvana, that you can achieve this extinguishing of the self and join the void and not be suffering ever anymore. And the Eightfold Path to eliminate desire, he laid out right understanding, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right awareness, and right meditation. Now, immediately you may think that right understanding means that there are certain things that you must believe as truth. And so there's tenets of theology that you need to understand. And that's not what Buddha means by this. He's not saying that there are basic things that you need to embrace as truth. What he's saying is that you need to have a right understanding that all suffering is caused by desire, and that the only way to get rid of it is to quit desiring things. So if you understand that, you have the right desire. The right speech, you may think that there's a certain way to speak, you know, treat people kindly and be moral and so forth in the way you speak. And that's part of Buddhism, but that's not what he means by right speech. What he means by right speech is you need to speak in such a way that you don't attach yourself to anything, because that creates desire. Right livelihood, was he saying that there's certain types of livelihood to pursue? No, that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that right livelihood means that you've picked a livelihood that gives you time to pursue this enlightenment. So it doesn't matter what you do as long as you're pursuing enlightenment. So the Eightfold Path really revolves around taking all of your attention and all your focus and moving it in a direction that you pursue enlightenment or you pursue nirvana, and that's really the Buddhist way. Now, there's a whole bunch more that goes behind that, but that's the Eightfold Path to eliminate desire and achieve enlightenment. What I'd like to do now is do a quick comparison between Buddhism and Christianity so you can kind of see the differences between the two. In Buddhism, truth is relative. In Christianity, truth is absolute. So in Buddhism, truth could be whatever it is to you. In Christianity, truth is absolute. In Buddhism, God is a void. That is, He's the emptiness of reality where nothing changes. And or some believe that people become little gods in this process. But in Christianity, God is an all-powerful, intelligent, moral, changeless, and infinite personal being. Okay? In Buddhism, the universe, there is no ultimate reality. All is an illusion. What you're seeing and experiencing here does not really exist. In Christianity, the universe is real, created and sustained by God. In Buddhism, evil is an illusion. There's no real right or wrong. There's no dark or light. It's all an illusion. It doesn't really exist. In Christianity, evil is real. It's the corruption of that which is good. In Buddhism, suffering is caused by desire in an illusory world. When we desire the things of this world that are really an illusion, that don't really exist, that's what causes suffering. In Christianity, suffering is caused by sin. A fallen world and free choices. People can sin. We live in a fallen world. People choose to do things that are wrong, and that's the cause of suffering in the world. In Buddhism, there's 10 precepts that we'll talk about a little later. Ethics in Christianity, God's moral law. And salvation to a Buddhist is to work toward reincarnation or through the process of reincarnation to the ultimate extinction of the ego into nirvana via the Eightfold Path. So the goal is to work to a point where you merge with the void or you become the void, which you already are. But once you're enlightened, then you know that you are, and then you connect with it and you experience an overwhelming peace and you become part of it. Christianity is much different in that salvation is the free gift of forgiveness and physical resurrection via faith in Christ's atoning work. Okay? So that's a comparison between the two. Now, much of this information I'm using for presentation purposes comes from a presentation done on Buddhism by Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. It's great material. If you get on Norm Geisler's website, you can get all kinds of great apologetic stuff in a lot of categories, but I want to give him credit for that. And also for the rest of the argument here, because I want to lay out for you some of the reasons why I believe Buddhism does not stand the test of truth. Okay, what is the evidence for Buddhism? Evidence is used to discover if something really is true. That's the purpose of evidence. In a trial, you bring forth evidence, testimony, witnesses to see if something really happened, if something corresponds to truth, to see if it corresponds to reality. And I would say that Buddhism does not correspond to reality, and I'm going to give you several reasons. Okay, this is not an attempt to be mean to people who embrace Buddhism. Okay, some of the things I'm going to suggest may cause you to chuckle a little bit, and the reason why they cause you to chuckle is because until you embrace an Eastern kind of thinking, you're going to find that most of the thinking is circular reasoning. And oftentimes when we talk about circular reasoning, which is embraced in Hinduism, is embraced in Buddhism as a very legitimate form of reasoning, it feels really strange to people who are used to thinking in more of a linear reasoning. Okay, what is the evidence for Buddhism? Well, number one, I would say Buddhism denies self and the world exists. Here's the problem with that. In doing so, Buddhists deny the undeniable. Logically, one can't deny that he exists because he must really exist in order to do so. In other words, denying self-existence is self-defeating and therefore false. Let me give it to you real clear. For me to say that I am not here is a proof that I am here. Because I could not say that I am not here unless I was here to say it. Do you see what I'm saying? You know, somebody gave me an example of circular reasoning between services that they saw in a Star Trek movie. And one of the guys in the Star Trek movie said, "Everything I'm telling you is a lie." You see the circular reasoning? So is the statement that you just made a lie, which would make everything else true? Or is the statement that you made just true, which means that everything that you say couldn't be a lie? In other words, they both can't exist at the same time. For me to say that I am absolutely convinced that I do not exist requires self-existence to be able to say that. And so for Buddha to say that he does not exist proves his existence. Because he couldn't say it if he wasn't there. What I'm suggesting to you is at the core of fundamental living, this philosophy doesn't work, doesn't make sense. Second example, it is obvious that all is not an illusion. In fact, one cannot know all is an illusion unless he knows what is real. You've got to know what is real before you can know what is not real. And you've got to know what is not real before you can know what is real. And so if we say that everything in this physical universe is not real, then we have to be able to validate or prove what is real. Otherwise, what we're seeing must be real. So it doesn't make sense to say that all is an illusion, because we would have to know something is real before we could say something is fake. In the First Noble Truth, Buddha actually defeats his own system because he says that suffering does exist in life. Remember, he left the palace and he went out and he saw people suffering, and he said that the Hindu concept that suffering is an illusion is really wrong. Suffering does exist. Well, if suffering is not an illusion, then how can everything be an illusion? I had a really difficult time understanding Buddhism, because Buddhism tries to bridge the gap between what we observe and Hindu thinking, which says what we observe is not real, and it creates an even greater illogical system because it doesn't work. So it's very, very confusing to try to put it together and make sense out of it, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Number three, Buddhism is built on subjective feelings, experiences, and philosophies of men rather than on any verifiable objective reality. But feelings alone are an inadequate test for truth. In other words, here's what Buddha said. Buddha said, I achieved nirvana, release, extinguishing of the soul. I achieved that sitting under the tree, and I had an incredible peace that came over me. Now the question is that true? Well, how would you know? Because it's his personal subjective experience. So basically, we're going to say that the feelings of this individual sitting under the tree create a reality that encompasses all of the universe, though there's no one that's ever gone there to the void and come back. There's no evidence of the void. We can't see it anywhere. There's nothing physical or tangible to verify it. It's the subjective feelings of an individual. And yet millions of people throughout history have followed with the goal that they would achieve the same thing that this one man says he experienced. I don't know about you, but feelings are kind of a scary thing to put your faith in. Just recently, there was a significant survey that was done in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, and the majority of people in the Muslim countries do not believe that there were any Arabs involved in the bombing of the World Trade Center. They just feel like that's a total fabrication. Does that make it true or not? Have you ever been misunderstood before? Someone looked you in the eye and said, yes, I know what you were trying to do. And you're going, where did that come from? That came from their feelings. Feelings are a very unreliable place to go when we're talking about the destiny of your human life, your human soul. Number four, nothing should be believed in the heart without first being filtered through the head. And many people would say that's a very Western concept. In fact, this came up in one of the debates that's written down about Buddha. There was a monk that came to Buddha, and he had a whole bunch of questions, and he was just loaded for debate. So he came to Buddha and he said, listen, He said, unless you can give me more evidence, unless you can give me a clearer understanding of eternity, of reality, of morality, of nirvana, of all this, unless you can make more sense out of the existence of human life than what you've taught so far, then I'm going to discredit you. I'm going to claim that you don't know what you're talking about. And Buddha's response to that was very interesting. He said to this monk, he said, you're like the person who's been shot with a poison arrow who says, until I can figure out who shot me, why they shot me, what kind of arrow they used, who manufactured or created the arrow, what it looks like, what it's made of, and what the poison is, then I'm not going to have anybody pull it out. You're spending too much time, Buddha said, trying to think logically or trying to understand your condition, when what you need to do is simply trust, follow the path, and you'll find healing. There's a problem with that thinking. And there's a problem with the example he used. In the example that he used, the monk can look and see the verifiable evidence that there is an arrow there. It's obvious there's real, reasonable, verifiable evidence to say, yes, yeah, somebody needs to pull this thing out. I don't care who it is. I don't care why they shot me. It's here. I can see it. It's verifiable. I'll die if I don't get it out. A better example of what Buddha teaches, or what Buddha taught, would be to say this. You wake up in the morning, man, you got something hurting in here. So you call your doctor on the phone. Doctor says, oh yeah, come on in. I got the cure for that. So you walk in there, sit on the table. Doctor doesn't pick up his stethoscope, doesn't take a chest x-ray, doesn't listen to your heart, doesn't take any vital signs, doesn't draw any blood. He just says, you know what, I can fix that. I know what your problem is. Show up tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock and be ready to go into surgery. And you say, well, what are you going to do? And he says, well, why are you asking so many questions? And you say, well, what's wrong? He said, it's obvious you're suffering, right? You came to me, I'm the doctor. Trust me. Well, now, wait a minute. I don't have any evidence except just this little pain in here to know that I need surgery. Well, see, while you're sitting around there trying to figure out, you're probably going to want a second opinion. You're going to probably want an x-ray. While you're sitting around trying to figure out what's wrong with you, you could die. Do you want that to happen? Just come in 6 o'clock tomorrow. We'll cut you open. Oh, you're going to cut me open? What do you mean you're going to cut me open? Oh, yeah, we're going to cut you open and we're going to take out your heart because that's what's causing the pain. Now, I'm not exaggerating. Follow my thinking here. Just follow my thinking. In the Buddhist construct, following the Eightfold Path is an ultimate issue of destiny, going into the void. In other words, there's no going back. Either it's true or it's not. If there is a personal God, and Buddhism is not true, and you gave your life to something that's not true, you're going to stand before a personal God. It's not an unserious issue. This is a big deal. But what he's saying, you know, just come in, we'll take out your heart, because you'll be better off that way. You will go into the void. You will cease to exist. And your suffering will go away. You'd say, there's no way I could do that without evidence. Show me something that substantiates that. Tell me why you would do that. And that's the problem when we just filter things through the heart and we don't think about them. And most of us would be very reluctant to live our lives on a day-to-day basis, manage our money, treat our health, on that kind of a basis. We're talking about our eternal destiny, our philosophy of life. I'll give you a couple more. Number 5, without an unchanging moral lawgiver, which Buddhism denies, there can be no objective moral laws. And yet Buddhism assumes such laws exist. For instance, the 10 precepts, the Eightfold Right Path, reincarnation based on actions. Buddhism is very clear that there are certain things that you can do and certain things you can't do. And if you do the wrong things, you violate the laws of karma, which are unchanging, which are immutable, which are absolute, and you go back and you do it again. Well, now, if there is no right or wrong, if there is no moral law, how can we be confident that the 10 precepts really truly are true? For example, within the 10 precepts, you have things like avoiding intoxicants, avoiding sexually immoral behavior. These are good things. And not taking any life of any kind. You know, within those, it's not that necessarily they're wrong, but the question is, how do you know those are right if you deny the existence of a moral lawgiver who says that they're right? Doesn't make any sense. Number six, it is impossible to eliminate suffering by eliminating all desire because such a goal involves desire to eliminate desire. I'm not saying that to be humorous. I'm just saying, I mean, that's what it is. When you're sitting there and your desire is to achieve a state of nothingness, to move into the void by denying all desire, what are you doing? You're desiring nirvana. And that's not the elimination of all desire. In fact, Buddha went down the path of asceticism trying with a desire to eliminate desire. And then he came back to sit under the fig tree with a desire to eliminate desire, from which he said he eliminated all desire. But then we know that he lived for about another 40 years after that. Did he eat during that time? Did he interact with people during that time? To eliminate all desire creates a desire. Number seven, there's no verifiable miraculous confirmation that the Buddhist scriptures are from God. In fact, there's not really any claim that these are miraculous. So there's nothing verifiable historically that we can look back to and say something supernatural happened that would prove that this really is true. Having said all that, in America today, Buddhist concepts are becoming mainstream. And everybody is very familiar with somebody that would normally be obscure as the head of a religious and political state, the Dalai Lama. But everybody knows that picture. Because in the United States today, people are buying and borrowing all kinds of different ideas, different Buddhist ideas. The problem is that most of it does not really reflect true Buddhism. And because this path is such a strange path, and there are many multiple facets or ways to take this thing and travel down it, there are a lot of people who think simply because they meditate or because they eat a certain kind of diet that they're Buddhists. But they don't believe all the rest of that. And so part of the struggle in talking to people who will say they're Buddhists is once you begin to explain your understanding of Buddhism, they say, oh, I don't believe any of that. In fact, the American concept of Buddhism very clearly tends to tie together materialism and the absorption in the self, which is opposite of what Buddha taught. People are using Buddhism or the principles of Buddhism to achieve health. Now, why would you want to achieve health? Do you desire health? It's going to cause you to suffer. To achieve wealth? Now, why would you want to achieve wealth? It's going to cause you to suffer. Using Buddhist principles to achieve a state of mental peace? Do you desire mental peace? If you desire mental peace, it's going to create a desire in you that's going to cause suffering. And yet, in the United States, we merge these concepts together and go to seminars and teach them. And it really doesn't work. So true Buddhism, the teachings of Buddha, don't really work real well in the Western world. And yet, people are buying it and getting involved and diving in left and right. And I want to just give you an illustration of this. One of the seniors at Cedar Park High School, Caitlin Murray, got involved in Buddhism, and I want you to see her story because it's a fascinating story. Let's hear from Caitlin.
Caitlin Murray, and I'm a senior at Cedar Park High School. When I first moved here, it was in fifth grade. My best friend was Unitarian Universalist, and I went to church with her, and I started going there for about the next 5 to 6 years. And in the Unitarian Church, there's a big emphasis on knowledge and understanding of different religions. So most of what we would do is study different religions and try to find the right path for us, pretty much is what they would say. And so I did extensive research of different world religions, including Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, whatnot. What initially attracted me to Buddhism was the idea of compassion and love, and it's a very tolerant religion. Tolerant of different kinds of people, and it has a lot of compassion for people, and that initially attracted me. And some of the ideas are very logical, like the idea that there's suffering in the world, and suffering comes from desire for things, and you have to give up that desire in order to be happy. And some of the ideas do make sense. So I started getting more involved in Buddhism, started reading different Buddhist texts from monks and talking to people who I knew were affiliated with Buddhism. And then later on, after a period of time, I started going to a temple in Austin that was based on off of a Chinese sect of Buddhism. And I started going there pretty regularly. During that time period, a lot of my Christian friends were very concerned about my salvation. They started asking me questions. The more they started asking about what I believed, the more I had to think about it. And they really forced me to think about, wow, what do I believe? And does this really make sense to me? And the more I started doing that, the more I realized that Buddhism doesn't answer a lot of questions that are really important, primarily about creation or what happens when you die. Very, very big questions they answer, but it's very vague. So it's hard to understand exactly what's going on and exactly what the basic teachings are on some things. That's when I really kind of started moving away from Buddhism, because people would ask me questions, and some of the questions I couldn't answer. There were things I couldn't tell them. I started researching more about Christianity. I started talking more to my Christian friends, and what I used to discount just because I had a closed mind seemed a lot more logical, seemed to make a lot more sense, and I started to learn a lot more. And I had some other experiences where I later realized that God was really, really calling me towards Him and really wanted me to learn more about Him and grow with Him. And then that's when I decided to make the commitment to Christianity and to Jesus. And I realized that, well, Buddhism has some good teachings. Those teachings are found in Christianity in different forms. The things I really liked about Buddhism were found in Christianity, and the things that Buddhism that I didn't think made sense and I didn't understand or didn't provide answers, Christianity was the answer.
A couple things that Caitlin says there that are real, real profound. And one of them is the biggest question that really all religions have to ask and answer, and it's certainly the biggest question that I think Hinduism and Buddhism has to answer, and that is this. If everything came or is part of this void or this Brahman, and that never changes, and we are all part of it, and what we experience in our consciousness or in ourself is simply a separation, but that's really who we are, we're all part of this thing, then how do we get separated in the first place? Because the very tenet is that that reality never changes. It's changeless. That's why it's perfect. But if I'm part of that, then how did I get separated from it? And would that not constitute a change? And I think what they would say is you're not separated from it. You just think you are. But that constitutes a change. So how did the consciousness thing break down? And she points that out. When it comes to the question of how did I get here, the answers become very vague. And they're philosophical in nature, and they tend not to be concrete enough to really understand. Second thing she pointed out is that there were many things that happened along the way in the process of her coming to Christian faith. One of them was she had some friends who cared enough to share with her and ask her questions in a loving way. In addition to that, God did some supernatural things. One night she woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning with this intense desire to read the Bible. But she knew that there was no Bible in her house, and she'd never seen one there before, so she started looking, and guess what? There was a Bible in her house. She found it and began to read. Not too long later, she was walking to school one day, and she happened to look down, and there was a Bible there that was just laying there on the ground. Another miraculous thing that God did to put the Word of God in her path. She found herself in an evangelistic Bible study that one of the families in our church hosts to help kids find truth. And that's through that process she came to faith. Which brings us really to the purpose of this message in summary, and that is when it comes to sharing the good news with Buddhists, there's a lot of good connection that Christians can make to help Buddhists come to an understanding of truth. Number one, when it comes to witnessing to Buddhists, we need to acknowledge and affirm our common ground. There's a lot of common ground that we can begin with. Things like, we understand that desire can cause suffering. People desire things that can create suffering for them. They also have a strong commitment to living a moral life, which we affirm and believe as well. And they believe strongly in prayer and meditation as a way to really connect with the spiritual. We believe in prayer and meditation, so there are a lot of places to start conversations and begin to talk because we have some things in common. In addition to that, we can explore the issue of desire. For the Buddhist, suffering comes from desire, so the goal is to kill desire. For the Christian, suffering also comes from desire, but it's for desiring the wrong thing. When I desire something that will not satisfy me, something that's inadequate, something that's immoral, that creates suffering. But in Christianity, we're told that we can have our desires satisfied in a relationship with our Creator, with God Himself. And that's what Jesus in Matthew 5 said, "Blessed are you who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for you will be satisfied." Desire can cause suffering. Do you kill desire or do you desire the right thing and find that desire fulfilled in God? Number three, share your hope in a personal God. Now keep in mind, for the Buddhist, what they're going to is a void, a nothingness, the end of their personal existence. When you pray, when you get on your knees at night and pray as a Christian, you're praying to a personal God, someone that can hear your prayers and answer them, someone that can relate to you, someone that can sympathize with you. And you have a hope. You're not headed to nothingness. You're not disappearing. It's not simply to avoid suffering. You're embracing a relationship with the eternal Creator of heaven and earth. Now, doesn't that offer something that's much more significant, much more peaceful, much more exciting to be able to be in the presence of God as you are a person related to God rather than simply non-existence? And then number four, focus on the hope of forgiveness. In Buddhism, the law is the law of karma. And if you break or violate the 10 precepts or many of their other moral laws, then you will come back in some form of reincarnation and you will live it again and you'll suffer it again. And so that means for many people who truly embrace Buddhism, now there are a lot of people who change it, but for the people who truly embrace it, what they're left with is living a life of knowing that when I mess up, I go on to the next. And I keep messing up, I go on to the next. Christianity offers a break in the cycle because it offers forgiveness. Jesus Christ died to pay for our sins so we can receive forgiveness. So we don't have to suffer through it over and over and over again, paying for our mistakes, paying for our violations, paying for our sins, paying for our ignorance throughout however many lifetimes it takes until I reach a place of enlightenment. Christianity offers true forgiveness, which it provides incredible hope for the person who's truly seeking to understand. And so what I would suggest is that we have an incredible opportunity to share the good news. And I would challenge you, take to heart this call. The gospel is liberating. The gospel is beautiful. The teachings of Jesus Christ change lives and they correspond to reality. And we offer those to people as a way of hope, in a way of meaning, in a way of life itself. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Father in heaven, as we come before you and thank you for truth, we also acknowledge that many times people embrace other concepts because they've been turned off by a stereotype of Christianity. Christians who are judgmental, Christians who are hypocritical, Christians who don't live their faith. And may we be people who truly reflect the love of Jesus Christ and the hope of forgiveness. Give us the courage to reach out, share the good news with those around us. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.